Welcome to All Sides with Ann Fisher. Longtime Boston Globe columnist Brian McGrory already had the best life ever, traveling the globe on an expense account, writing about interesting people and events, and with the best dog ever, Harry, his beloved golden retriever that was everything a pet should be, loyal and submissive and friendly. That Harry would lead him to the antithesis of all of that is the crux of Brian McGrory's new book. It's called Buddy, How a Rooster Made Me a Family Man. Brian McGrory is with us today to talk about why he's a better man because of Buddy the Rooster. Welcome to the show, Brian.
Thank you, Ann. I appreciate you having me on.
So we've talked about chickens as pets on the show before, and there was a little controversy a few years back in a local suburb about chickens in people's backyards and that sort of thing. And the question came up often, are chickens people too? The chicken owners tried to say that, these are like pets to us. These aren't just egg producers.
I mean, first of all, there's a big difference between a hen and a rooster. I would have killed to have hens. In comparison, hens are pleasant, quiet animals. Roosters are dominant and loud. I will tell you that Pam loved Buddy more than I could ever possibly imagine. I mean, these two had a relationship that was really quite extraordinary. And Buddy, Buddy loved the Buddy's dead now, but Buddy loved the kids, loved Pam, loved everything in this household except for me.
They called him Boo Boo. I love that. Among many other pet names.
Yeah, they had a million nicknames. Boo Boo, most prominently. This rooster lived a life like you can't imagine. He had the free run of the yard. We're in a distant suburb. We have a pretty sizable yard. He would hang around our porches. He lived in his own big rooster shed every night in the side yard with cedar doors and a transom window. Every day he was delivered a breakfast of cracked corn, oatmeal, cheese, watermelon. He really lived a pretty grand life.
It wasn't until you actually moved into this new house with Buddy somewhere in the yard, I guess, or maybe downstairs, that you realized he crowed one morning and it kind of sunk in that you were living with this rooster.
Well, Buddy, the way Buddy came into this world is Harry was my golden retriever.
Right.
And Harry was, as you alluded to, one of the most noble creatures, perhaps the most noble creature I've ever met, just an extraordinary dog. I really believe you get one great dog in life, and Harry was it for me.
Mm-hmm.
And Pam was Harry's vet. And when Harry died back in 2004, after that, Pam and I struck up a relationship, life took its course. We got engaged and bought a house and, came to be together here in the suburbs. I moved from the city out to the suburbs of Boston. I'd been in the city my whole adult life. Pam had all these things that were incredibly foreign to me. First off, there's life in suburbia, two children, four rabbits, two Maine Coon cats. And this rooster, the rooster was born as part of a science fair in her oldest daughter's third grade class. They had an incubator. Abigail and her father had an incubator and some chicken eggs, and one hatched. Out came Buddy. They kept the chick. They coddled it. They cuddled it. It was living in the house in a cage. It graduated to a dog crate. Then when Pam thought it was a hen, she put it out in the yard. The chicken would wait on the stoop for Pam to come home from work and the kids to come home from school. It would sleep on a shelf in the garage. It had the run of the yard. It lived this great life. And then one day it started sprouting a crown on its head and developed this barrel chest and suddenly started croaking and then crowing. And it was like, oh, boy, we've got ourselves a rooster.
Which makes a big difference, as you pointed out earlier.
Oh, God, a huge difference. I mean, the rooster still loved Pam and the kids. I mean, he would follow Pam around the yard like a lovesick little puppy, just kind of clucking. And he would see her from a distance and race in her direction. The kids would still bring him inside most nights to sit on the couch and watch television with them. It was kind of bizarre. And the answer to the question you haven't asked is no, you cannot house train a rooster. So the rooster loved the kids, loved Pam, and hated my guts. You know, we bought a house together. We moved into this new place. And he just never understood why this pathetic little man was trying to intercede invoke himself into this flock that he had already established. He just didn't get why I was there.
My guest is Brian McGrory. He's an author, a Boston Globe columnist, and we're talking about his newest book. It's called Buddy, How a Rooster Made Me a Family Man. Brian, you make the distinction, not just makes you a better family man, but how it makes you a family man, not just a better man. What was the family part of that?
Well, that's a great question. It's I'm of the belief that you really do learn incredible lessons from animals, that you draw from animals. And from Harry, my golden retriever, I really learned to open up and to be more empathic and to share more of myself and to care for somebody, something in a way that I didn't know I had the capacity to do. I mean, Harry just taught me extraordinary things about myself. All of them very gentle lessons. So then I come out to suburbia, and I'm making this incredible transition in my 40s, and I am terrified of Pam's kids. I mean, I am just terrified of them. You know, they're 7 and 9 years old when I got involved, and they were pretty scary creatures to me. And I had never been around anything like this, and I'd never been in the suburbs. I'd never had to get in a car to go get a cup of coffee. I'd never had a 45-minute commute to work, and I've never had people banging at the bathroom door when I'm trying to take a shower and all of that kind of stuff. And so I'm learning to cope with that, and I'm watching Buddy, and Buddy started playing the role as my own personal drill sergeant. I mean, I'm looking at this creature in the yard, and he is so content with everything within his fence line. He's just patrolling his area and loving every bit of it and everyone in it except for me, not thinking about what he was missing, only about what he had. And as odd as it may sound, I just started looking at him saying, you know, you little jerk, you've really got it all figured out.
I was thinking about the obviously great pet that Harry was and the not so obviously great pet that was Buddy. And I thought that's exactly the way people can be. Obvious and not so obvious, and it made the whole animal kingdom very mysterious to me in a way. That we're all a lot more alike when we are different.
I think you're exactly right. And look at to like I've said to Pam and the kids, Buddy was like an ideal little pet. He would he had one personality with them and another with me. With them, he would cluck and coo and give these little love pecks. With me, he would squawk and screech, chase me around the yard when I was just trying to throw the tennis ball with the dogs. He would basically try to castrate me when I was trying to grill a hamburger on our gas grill. I mean, he was just a completely different animal with me. And, you're right. I mean, people are all different, and the animal kingdom is very much like that as well.
You wrote about the different ways he would attack you. Can you read a little bit from that in your book?
I will. You just stop me when you want me to stop, and I'll
there
read
are so
here.
Many ways, right?
Buddy developed numerous ways to attack me. Like an all-star pitcher, expert at changing his speeds. He was so slick, so seemingly knowledgeable about my movements around the yard, where he might trap me, how I'd react, when he would thrust, whether he should parry. It wouldn't have surprised me if he sat in his rooster house in the dark of the night studying film. Interesting. When he's with the dogs, he never looks behind him, Buddy might have thought. And when he's reading the paper, he's essentially blocking his own view of anything in front of him. Look at how he's lamenting the condition of his lawn in the far corner, basically trapping himself in an area with no escape. There was, of course, the blitz. I'm out in the yard, Buddy says, screw it, and charges like a linebacker jacked up on every imaginable steroid. There was no finesse involved with that, no fakery, no mild chicanery. No, it was just Buddy sprinting in my direction, usually while caw-cawing in as menacing a voice as he could muster, his beady little eyes bulging out of the sides of his furious, puffed-out face. Unless and until you've had a 20-pound rooster racing at your legs and midsection at a speed you didn't think possible for him to achieve, it's hard to imagine the gamut of emotions involved. White shock, abject fear, a hazy sense of regret that you may never partake in sexual relations again.
This went on for years, right?
Oh, God. years. 3 years. Buddy lived for 3 years. I remember one afternoon, Pam was out doing errands, or she was out somewhere. I had the kids at home. And I'm upstairs Googling the question, what is the lifespan of a rooster? His Buddy is pecking at the front door as loud as he could possibly peck. And the answer I got was 15 years for a well-cared-for rooster. And I'm thinking, well, that means Buddy's going to live to about 50. He ended up dying of a heart attack, and I do have an alibi in case you were wondering, but he died of a heart attack at 3 years. And Pam came to find out, Pam's a veterinarian, and she came to find out that he was what's known as a broiling breed, which is as sad as it sounds. His body was never meant to live beyond a year or two because it was always assumed he would be killed and eaten. And his body just couldn't support the kind of active life he ended up living.
So he actually lived a little bit longer. It was very sad. You were very sad when he died.
I was. I feel a little odd to admit it. But, you know, toward the end, the last year or so, that last winter especially, Buddy died this past May. And that last winter, he really started calming down and settling down with me. He spent the bulk of the winter lying on our covered back deck on a bed of towels and quilts, just watching the world around him very quietly and very content. And every evening, Pam would go outside and pick him up and carry him down to the basement of our house because she didn't want him sleeping in a cold rooster house. So he'd sleep on a desk, on top of a desk in our basement, and then in the morning we'd bring him back out again. I even learned to carry him up and down in and out from the basement to the deck, and we did it without him pecking at me. He started growing accepting of me as I think he realized, you know, this guy's may not be all bad. I started growing more accepting of him as I realized, you know, this bird's got it all figured out.
So it's Thanksgiving. Do you have a lot of other pets? Do you give thanks for your pets at Thanksgiving?
Oh, God, yeah. We have two golden retrievers now. We have two Maine Coon cats that I fought the acquisition vociferously. I was dead set against getting cats, and I was rolled over like a jelly bean. And now I'm almost embarrassed at how much I love these cats. We have four rabbits. Somewhere in the house is a fish and a frog. Just a lot of animals around everywhere. And it really makes the house feel full and alive to have these creatures. As I'm talking to you, I'm staring at a cat named Charlie sprawled across my desk and a golden retriever named Walter lying on the floor. So it really does make a difference. And you know, in many respects, what this book is about is blended families. You know, certainly the obvious, the interspecies blending, but also, you know, and I think this is more and more common, you know, people finding love later in life, maybe for a first time, often for a second time, getting involved with kids when they're not used to it, the terrors and trials, tribulations, triumphs of step-parenting, and all that goes into it. And that's in many ways, you know, the book is about a chicken, it's about a dog, but it's also about these kind of great transitions later in life and what you have to go through to make things work.
Well, Brian McGrory, it was a great book to read. It made me very sad at the end, but that just means Buddy felt like a good pet. So thanks for sharing the story with us today.
And I really appreciate you having me on. I will just say that one of the great developments here in Boston in the last year is getting Grater's ice cream sold in our local supermarkets. It's in many ways changed my life. God, do I love that stuff.
All right. Grater's Ice Cream. A little pitch for Grater's. Brian McGrory, thanks again for joining us. Appreciate it.
Thanks, Ann. Take care.
You too. Brian McGrory, he's an author and Boston Globe columnist, and we've been talking about his new book. It's called Buddy, How a Rooster Made Me a Family Man. When we return, we'll continue our conversation about how pets make us better people. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
This is 89.7 NPR News, 28 degrees in downtown Columbus, sunshine today and a high near 40 degrees. Clear skies tonight and a low of 25, a few clouds for tomorrow and a high of 45, and then a rain-snow mix looking ahead to Sunday with highs in the mid-30s. Support comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting dancer and choreographer Faye Driscoll's You're Me. The new critically acclaimed evening-length duet explores the complex nature of relationships. Now through March 23rd in the Wexner Center for the Arts, details at wexarts.org. And All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about how our pets make us better people. Joining me now is Dr. Megan Heron, who heads the Behavioral Medicine Clinic at the Ohio State University Veterinary Medical Center, where she helps owners rehab their pets with behavior issues. Welcome to the show, Megan.
Thanks, Anne. A pleasure to be here.
To our listeners, how has one of your pets made you a better person? Give us a call and tell us your story, 614-292-8513, or email us at allsides@wosu.org. So I described you as someone who helps owners rehab their pets with behavior issues, but I wonder to what extent often is it that the owner has the behavior issue?
Well, I will say it's probably a combination of both. To be honest, I see a lot of troubled patients. I see a lot of dogs and cats that have had pretty severe histories of either neglect or abuse, and they suffer the behavioral consequences of that later in life, unfortunately, which is often the problem with rescued or adopted pets who we just either don't know their history or it was one that we know is of neglect. And so a lot of owners who've had dogs all their lives have never had a special needs animal, might not be managing them appropriately for their special needs, but I tend not to blame the owners too often. I just kind of help them go into the right direction to help their pets.
When you're helping somebody work through an issue with a pet, do you see them change at all as they master that?
And
I hate to use the word master or get to know their pet and understand what their needs are.
Well, a lot of times I think one of the most beneficial parts of an owner coming to see me for an appointment is having an understanding of their pet's behavior problem. A lot of people come to me and there's a lot of anger. I mean, I have dogs that are biting their owners severely, attacking other pets in their household, urinating all over their beds and favorite clothing. So there's a lot of anger and a lot of unhappiness. And I probably see a lot of owner-pet relationships that are hanging on by a thread. That human-animal bond is on the verge of collapse. And so I feel when I can provide an understanding and a little bit of empathy of what's actually going on with the behavior problem of their pet, it just gives them a whole new look at things. And then when they actually see that they can make progress and make change, it's unbelievable. The bond that they have with that animal, I think, is almost even stronger than a pet that doesn't have behavior problems because they worked through some of those really difficult issues.
I guess the fact that you even exist in the position that you exist in says something about how our relationship with our pets is changing or becoming more significant.
Absolutely, Anne. The human-animal bond has evolved substantially over the past decade or two. I mean, I have people pay a lot of money to see me for dogs that are biting them. I think, you know, in the past, that would have been, you know, sentenced for dropping off at a shelter or dropping you off, you know, somewhere in the middle of the road. But nowadays, people actually are bonded to their pets. They feel like they've made a commitment to their pet and they're willing to work and do whatever it takes to work through these problems and maintain them in their home. So, absolutely.
Brian McGrory wrote about the intelligence of Buddy the Rooster. We talked about that in the last segment. We didn't talk about his intelligence, but I was amazed at, as he described it from his research, the cognitive skills of the rooster And are animals really smarter than we used to think, or smarter in ways that we didn't credit them for before?
I think animals have quite a bit of intelligence that we don't realize. And even if it's not the higher sort of thought process and planning and reasoning that a human being might have with that, you know, much larger forebrain that we have as humans, there's still quite a bit of thought process and problem solving. And definitely, I think their ability to make associations, so simple connections, is probably even greater in animals because they don't have a lot of that upper higher cognitive learning getting in the way. You know, they know. I remember I used to drive home from vet school, and my dog knew the sound of my car like nobody else. Do you think any of my roommates happened to notice? Absolutely not. But they could pick on just the slightest subtlety. They could pick up on subtleties of your body language that we as human beings don't even tend to notice. So I think that ability to make those simple associations is even stronger in animals than it is in humans.
Why does my dog always pop the tennis ball under the couch, knowing that it just makes me, it ticks me off and frustrates me, and I can't stand getting down under, I have to dig out under the couch and get the ball. I mean, she does it over, she's been doing it since she was a puppy.
Yeah. I don't know that she knows that it ticks you off, but she certainly knows it gets you up off the couch and gets you interacting with her. So then it's basically a self-reinforced behavior that seems to work out well for her.
There's a lot of balls under the couch, though. I don't always do it. You know, at a pet training class once, a teacher told us that, or a dog training class, I guess, a teacher told us that this was more about training us than the animal.
So I think it's very important that we are trained ourselves. But most importantly, I think for people to understand, to have a really good connection and understanding with their pets, is to be very consistent, predictable, and to provide structure. I think animals, when they live in an environment that isn't structured, that isn't predictable, where owners have inconsistent rules of, well, sometimes I want you on my lot, and other times it makes me really upset and I don't want you here. It's really difficult for them. That can cause a lot of stress, a lot of anxiety, and then that can manifest itself in other behavior problems, such as aggression, inappropriate elimination, and so on and so forth.
Yeah, and she really encouraged us to have the whole family come in
absolutely.
And to the class, not just the mom or the dad or something like that.
Right, and whenever I see my patients, I really encourage as many family members or anyone who really interacts with the pet on a regular basis to attend the appointment because I need their input, and I also need everybody to be consistent in how we're going to manage and treat this animal because inconsistency is just going to cause confusion and potentially make the problem worse.
If you're just joining us, this is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News. My guest is Dr. Megan Herron. She's animal behavior clinician and head of the Behavioral Medicine Clinic at the Ohio State University Veterinary Medical Center. If you have a question or comment for Megan, give us a call, 614-292-8513. You can email us at allsides@wosu.org. Do you have a pet that you think has made you a better person? We'd love to hear your story. Give us a call, email us. You can also go to our Facebook page and post your question or comment there. In the book about Buddy the Rooster, everyone called him Boo Boo, among many other. I mean, they had so many nicknames for him. It was hysterical. Is Boo Boo a universal endearment for a pet? And what does it mean when we do that with our pets?
Well, that may be more for a human psychologist question, but I think absolutely. I think, you know, the reason we are drawn to a lot of pets and our animals is that we sort of take on a parental role. You know, we're a caretaker, a caregiver, or a provider. And so I think it's only natural that we develop sort of nicknames that we might do for children or those in need.
Absolutely. And do you notice any, is Boo Boo pretty common or? Or they're not merely necessarily engaged in endearing remarks at that point.
I was going to say, I've probably heard a lot worse.
And we're hearing about pets being prescribed drugs like Prozac and that sort of thing, behavior modification drugs. What do you know about those and the trend toward that?
So actually, psychotropic drugs are medications are something that I use quite often in a lot of my patients. I tend to see by the time they're coming to see me at a specialty hospital, I tend to see, again, we are human-animal bond on the brink of collapse. So a lot of these animals have serious behavioral problems or anxiety issues. And in some of those cases, these animals are actually putting their own life at risk. I have had patients that have pushed out air conditioning conditioning units and jumped out three-story buildings. I've had them claw their way out of doors in response to a thunderstorm. I've had dogs get their mouths stuck and break their jaws trying to escape a crate. So not just their own injury to themselves. I've had patients that will also lick themselves raw. I've had cats that were mutilating themselves by biting. These are serious issues that really do require a medical intervention. And in the other cases, their anxiety may be leading to behaviors that are really damaging that human-animal bond, that are they're going to cause that animal to lose its life because it's going to be either euthanized or relinquished to a shelter, which may end up euthanizing that animal. So essentially, their life potentially is at risk then. So a lot of times, if we can intervene by decreasing that anxiety or reactivity problem with a medication, we can really save lives and improve quality of life as well.
Marilyn in Columbus, you're on the air. You have a question for Dr. Heron. Welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you. My question is, my sister is an animal lover. She has had dogs, and for some reason, our niece's dog will just unexpectedly bite her.
Bite your niece?
Bite my sister.
Okay.
Okay.
And we can't figure out, no, the dog came from a shelter, and we think it had been abused.
Mm-hmm.
And we think maybe it's around 2 years old.
Mm-hmm. Did the biting just start? Is this something new?
Well, if she's alone in the house with that dog, the dog will growl at her. And mm-hmm. We were all together as a family the other evening, and my sister was just, we were sitting there talking, and the dog just suddenly bit her on the forearm.
Was she petting the dog or interacting with it at all?
No, she was just sitting there.
Okay, goodness. Well, again, as we were talking about before, some of these rescue dogs that have a very troubled history, sometimes they can have some really unsettling trust issues. So although this seems like this dog is being mean or sort of picking on her, I bet the true root of this problem is that dog is a little bit afraid of her, probably has some trust issues. And I feel like if we had a video camera and we could look at every dog bite, unless that dog is having some sort of abnormal seizure, I think we could always look back and find some sort of provocation that to us as humans seems very, very benign, but from the dog's perspective is actually quite frightening. So for example, someone sitting in a chair with their legs crossed, just bouncing their leg, just the movement of that foot from that dog's perspective can be frightening enough for them to bite
mm-hmm.
it. Same with an arm. So if she was relaxed with her arms and suddenly moved it, either making a hand gesture or moving, somehow that dog perceived it was a threat to its own safety and used aggression to try to protect itself. And we never know why some dogs pick out certain people in their body language and why that person seems to be a target of aggression more than others.
Maybe the same color hair as the person. I mean, you just don't know.
You just don't know. But you know what I hear a lot and what I'm hearing you say is that your sister's a dog lover.
Well,
and I find that some of the dog lovers tend to get themselves into more trouble because they're trying to express more affection, more love, and really trying to interact with that animal. And from the animal's perspective, they just don't understand that that's a friendly gesture. So I do find that some of the animal lovers get themselves into trouble a little more just on their own trying to be friendly. Whereas people who tend to ignore the dogs and want nothing to do with them, those dogs seem to cling to them. It's very interesting in that manner. Again, for a dog with, you know, a troubled history, like it sounds like your niece's dog has.
Do you think this dog is a candidate for some behavior modification?
Absolutely.
Or some
work?
I
see patients like this all the time.
Because it's not this way around everybody, so...
Right, so something we could work on. And how do we build that trust? How do we get this dog to trust, you know, your sister so that she can feel safe around this dog again?
Okay, Marilyn, good luck to your sister.
Well, thank you.
Okay, take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye. Doug in Elyria, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, Doug.
Thank you.
You're on the air. Welcome. What's your question?
I just want to let you know that my family had been in the veterinary business for over 40 years. My dad was the OVMA president.
Oh, great.
Several years ago, and I have a brother that's a veterinarian, a cousin. And,
wow, you know, really runs in the family.
Right, I was an animal warden here in Lorain County, and I've found that a lot of dogs have anxiety problems and that, you know, when you leave the house or something, they'll have anxiety.
A lot. Yeah, separation anxiety. I see that quite a bit. These dogs can really, really panic in that home alone environment. I mean, again, I have them jumping out windows and, you know, breaking their jaws.
Well,
trying
I've
to
heard
escape.
That's one of the biggest, best arguments for a good crate experience and, and crating them. It's to protect them.
Right, and you need to start that young. If they don't learn it young, or if they have a bad experience when they're young, they can potentially see the crate as something bad for the rest of their lives.
Right, Doug. Thanks for your call.
Thank you.
Yeah, thank you. Take care. Carol in Plain City, you're on the air with Dr. Megan Heron. Welcome.
Hi, how are you? I have this question about this. I have a 7-year-old neutered male Welsh Corgi who thinks he's the cat policeman. So whenever the cats get it, which is when I have multiple cats, whenever they get into a spat or the two young ones are ripping around the house, tearing around, he starts barking and racing after them to police it. Okay, and unfortunately, he usually goes after the fleeing cat who isn't the instigator. And we've yelled at him, but sometimes he takes off at such a rapid pace, he's actually scratched the wood floor.
Oh,
so I know corgis are busybodies. I've had corgis for a long time, but what is this? Is this the fleeing motion? What does this need to interfere constantly?
Sounds like a herder.
I was just going to say, you have a corgi, and so that's almost, you know, trying to yell no or, you know, punish that behavior is pretty fruitless, as you may find. I mean, he's a corgi. He's driven. It's almost instinctual, and it's interesting to hear you say it's the fleeing motion that triggers that, because it's almost innate, that quickly moving, you know, being, whatever that may be, particularly if there are multiple. It's almost, it just triggers this, got to chase, got to herd, got to move behavior. It's very difficult to change. So what you end up having to do is manage it and giving the cats plenty of escape routes, high places to go, places
to hide.
You know,
they don't fight. He doesn't hurt them.
Yeah.
And once they stop, if they stop running, he doesn't know what to do.
He's like, wait a minute.
You know.
So
and I do ask him sometimes when they get out, because they're not allowed out, to go get the cat and herd him back.
Well,
and
anybody does.
And he does. But if the cats stop running, he looks at me like, now what?
Now what?
Because he has no concept of what to do. But in the house, it's not appropriate. And now that I've got a 7-month-old Abyssinian who's flying all over the walls and, you know, and another 4-year-old cat, it's kind of chaotic sometimes. And I guess, is it possible at this age to teach him? It's gotten worse. As they mature, I notice corgis get a little bit more like this.
Mm-hmm.
Is there a way that, you know, so I have to keep a lead on him, and whenever there's a spat, tug him, you know what I'm saying, before he even thinks about it? Or am I really going to make him real frustrated with his instinctual need to go chasing? And if fortunately, as I said, he's always going after the non-instigator, because that's the one that's fleeing.
That's one that's
so
fleeing.
Changing him going to mess with his head?
Well, I think if you need to provide other outlets for him, but you also need to think about the welfare of that calf that's really becoming quite frightened. So it might be a matter of keeping a lead on him and then redirecting him to another behavior. You know, you can mentally stimulate him through other behavior training. You know, let's play, leave it. Let's teach you how to do a downstay on a relaxed mat so that you can do something else with your brain that's a little more productive and safer for the cats. And maybe only allow short periods of time with that cat. Because I think once that cat gets a little more used to him and realizes he's not actually a threat, the cat will stop fleeing. And that's what's really going to solve your problem, is to get the cats to stop fleeing and provide him other outlets for that behavior. I don't think you'll mess with his head too much, but you got to protect your kitties too.
Carol, thanks a lot for your call. We appreciate it. Take care. I'm going to squeeze one more in real quick. John in Columbus, you're on the air. Welcome to the show, John.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question. How does the doctor feel about shock collars for obedience training?
So shock collars. So as I said, most of the patients I see are coming to me with anxiety and fear-related problems. So for example, I might have a dog that barks and lunges and growls and snarls at, you know, every unfamiliar dog he passes on a leash. And, you know, from the human perspective, to us, that's an undesirable behavior. And our instinct, we want to punish that. And so there are various forms of punishment, whether that's a shock collar, a harsh leash correction, or some other collar that provides pain to that behavior. And so what we do in that situation, which I've seen a lot, is we might shock the dog, we might leash correct the dog, and in that moment, we might temporarily inhibit the behavior. The problem is, with most of those dogs that are displaying that behavior, the underlying motivation for it is out of fear and a perception that that dog is a threat to that dog's personal space or safety or owner. And so what we're really doing is just sort of putting a cap on a really big emotional problem. And so I find the use of shock collars in that most of those situations tends to just inhibit some early warning signs and inhibit a behavior problem that's a manifestation of an involuntary emotion. So I find it might be effective at temporarily inhibiting what that behavior is in that moment, but it's not really useful at solving the underlying issue. Does that answer your question?
It does, yes. Thank you.
You're welcome.
All right. Thank you, John.
Thanks.
You're listening to Dr. Megan Heron. She's head of the Behavioral Medicine Clinic at Ohio State University. Coming up, we're going to meet a researcher who did look specifically at what pets do for us and how they can make us better people. So stay with us. We'll be right back. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.
A report commissioned by the Republican Party itself says they're too old, too white, and too intolerant, but they're not going to change their policies, just their approach. Look for Rand Paul to tell us how he loves jamming to groovy tunes on his hi-fi. I'm Peter Sagal. We're old and dull, but it's our niche. Join us for Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, the news quiz from NPR.
Wait, Wait, Don't Tell Me, tomorrow morning at 11 on 89.7 NPR News. Stay right here in 20 minutes at 11 o'clock. It's All Sides Weekend and a discussion about the best places to visit in Ohio for spring tourism and travel. That's All Sides Weekend Travel from 11 till noon on 89.7 NPR News. And it's 29 degrees. Expect sunshine today with a high near 40. Clear skies tonight and a low of 25. A few clouds for tomorrow and some sunshine, a high near 45 degrees. Support for 89.7 comes from Home Care Assistance, in-home care for older adults with a philosophy of promoting health, well-being, and quality of life for all clients, no matter their limitations. Information on Home Care Assistance is at 481-8888. That's 481-8888. And support comes from the Wexner Center for the Arts, presenting dancer and choreographer Faye Driscoll's You're Me. The new critically acclaimed evening-length duet explores the complex nature of relationships, now through March 23rd in the Wexner Center for the Arts. Details at wexarts.org. All Sides continues on 89.7 NPR News.
We're talking about how pets can make us better people. Still with me is Dr. Megan Heron, who heads the Behavioral Medicine Clinic at OSU Veterinary Medical Center. She helps owners rehab their pets with behavior issues. Joining us now from Oxford, Ohio, well, actually from O'Hare Airport, is Dr. Alan McConnell. He's a social psychologist whose research examines, among other things, the psychology of pet ownership. Welcome to the show, Dr. McConnell.
Thank you, Ann.
In the article published about your research on this topic last year in the Journal of Personality and Social Psychology, you and your fellow researchers started with this quote in a story by Mark Twain. If you pick up a starving dog and make him prosperous, he will not bite you. This is a principal difference between a dog and a man. How did that relate to your research, or did it inspire it?
I don't know if it inspired it, but I think the motivating force for our research was to try to understand whether or not pets have benefits for everyday people. In the past, there have been a lot of studies conducted with kind of at-risk populations, people who had suffered heart attacks, the elderly who had a lot of doctor's visits, and we saw evidence in those sorts of clinical studies that pet ownership had beneficial consequences, but really no one had studied whether just everyday people who weren't facing health challenges could enjoy those benefits.
So what were the experiments? How did you do this?
Well, we did a number of experiments. Some of them were correlational because, obviously, a lot of this is things we can't control, but we also did some experimental work as well. One thing that we did is we did a couple surveys, large surveys, looking at community samples and comparing people who did have pets and people who didn't have pets, and that we found on a number of measures that the pet owners were healthier on a very, you know, kind of common everyday sort of measures that we use to assess things like loneliness, self-esteem, issues like that. And then in the second study, we wanted to try to understand exactly what it was that the pets did for people. So we looked at another sample and basically gauged the extent to which their pet provided meaningful social support, and then looked at whether or not that would predict a variety of health outcomes. And what we found was that people who had kind of better relationships with their pets were less depressed, were less lonely, had fewer physical illnesses, were happier, and were less stressed out.
In the process of your research, did you learn anything about the people themselves? In other words, a certain kind of person is going to tend to have a pet in the first place?
You know, we looked at some of those issues. We looked at differences between pet owners and non-pet owners. In addition to the well-being measures, we looked at a variety of personality factors, and we found some things that were related. So we found that, you know, that pet owners tended to have healthier personalities. They were greater in conscientiousness, so they're better organized. They kind of, you know, don't fall behind on things. They had better attachment styles. So basically, an attachment style is kind of our model for how we feel a romantic relationship or a personal relationship should be, and there are healthy ones where you kind of view yourself positively and view others positively, or there can be some negative ones, and we found that the pet owners tended to have more healthy attachment styles. So in a number of personality variables, we saw that pet owners tended to be healthier rather than less healthy.
How did your research tease out the causative from the correlative? In other words, how did you make that distinction?
Well, you know, that's one of the tricky things. I mean, you really can't go around and walk up to somebody with a dog and just take their dog away and say, well, we're doing this for science, you know. But one thing that we did do in the lab is we brought in a variety of Miami University undergraduates, and we had them write for 5 minutes about a time in their life when they felt socially rejected and isolated. This is a pretty common way to induce a sense of social rejection and isolation. So we had them write about that for 5 minutes. And then we experimentally, based on random assignments, had these pet owners either write about their best friend, their pet, or we had them do a control activity where they basically drew a map of the campus. And what we found is that when people experienced this rejection manipulation, they felt worse in terms of their social need fulfillment. But when people were able to spend 5 minutes writing about their pet, they were just as buffered from that negativity that came from that social rejection as they were thinking about their best friend. So this is one way for us to kind of experimentally demonstrate that people can really rely on their pet the same way they might rely on their best friend to kind of deal with loneliness and kind of build a sense of social connection.
Dr. Megan Heron, in the process of what you do, helping people rehab their pets, did you ever come across somebody that isn't the right kind of personality to have a pet, that they just don't get it?
I have had that. Often what I see are mismatches. So they might have the personality for a type of pet, which might be maybe an older house cat that isn't very active, but they end up with potentially a dog that has a lot of working tendencies that needs aren't being met. So sometimes it's not really a good match. Or in some cases, I've had people, there's not an instruction manual when you obtain a pet, unfortunately. So I've had people who didn't realize you were supposed to let a dog outside to go to the bathroom. You know, well, I just put a potty pad in the upstairs bathroom. Don't they just know to use that? You know, it's not intuitive. You know, we learn how to take care of pets, and unfortunately, they don't always come with that. So, yes, I've absolutely seen that. Some people just maybe aren't appropriate for pets or are inappropriately matched with the current pet that they have.
Dr. McConnell, were these strictly dog owners that you worked with?
We've looked at both. So in one of our studies, we looked only at dog owners because we actually studied dog personality as well as people personality. But in the other two studies, it was pet owners in general, whether it was cats, dogs. Sometimes it was, you know, snakes or horses. It was a variety of different types of animals.
And did one stand out as more of the type that makes people feel these senses of security or all the satisfaction that they feel from having a pet?
Well, I think that's one of the interesting things. I think everybody has their pet theory. You know, if they're a dog person, they are strong advocates that dogs are better than cats, and that's what they expect. But what we found, and kind of surprisingly, because there are some studies in the literature that suggest dogs may have greater benefits, but what we found in our research so far in a number of studies is that the type of animal really doesn't matter. So whether it's a cat or a dog or, you know, a turtle, what have you, it seems to really boil down to the sort of ways that the pet owner anthropomorphizes the pet, the way that the owner kind of views the pet as being a meaningful entity. And it seems that people can do that, whether it's a big, you know, sort of, you know, Irish setter or whether it's a rabbit.
I always wondered about people who keep their pets outdoors, never allow them in the house, don't have that daily interaction or moment-to-moment interaction with them. I mean, did you talk to people like that, Dr. McConnell, that, I mean, their idea of a pet might be different than somebody else's?
Yeah, you know, that's one interesting thing is that in our first study, we had like almost 300 people participate, and a lot of the sample came from Southwest Ohio. So a number of these people were not college. You know, most of these people had no affiliation with Miami University. A lot of them worked on farms and lived on farms, and we saw a lot of that sort of functionality that, you know, people kind of viewed this animal for protection, viewed it to, you know, play certain roles in terms of hunting and things like that. And although those people were a little less likely to anthropomorphize their pets, they seemed to get the same sort of benefits, whether, you know, the dog slept in their bed or whether the dog slept in a doghouse outside. There seems to be something, again, about what that person kind of, you know, projects onto their pet that really matters, and kind of the physical state of whether the dog's an indoor dog or an outdoor dog didn't predict anything in our studies.
Yeah, Dr. Heron, does the pet perceive any difference in how they're treated, whether or not, with, as long as they're, what the human's projecting is positive?
I think it depends what the animal's experience was during the early socialization period. I think if you have a dog who was used to being a house dog, sleeping in beds, being on furniture, having constant attention and affection from people, and then to then put them in an environment that's outdoors with less social interaction, I think that could be highly stressful. However, if they're raised in the environment of, they have, you know, and owners are still projecting that, you know, kind of positive affection and interactions, but that's what they're used to as a puppy, then I think it could be quite a good quality of life for them in that situation.
Are some, let's just talk about dogs, are some dogs more people dogs than others? I mean, that they just love people?
We definitely see certain breeds that tend to have a predisposition to really bonding quite strongly with people. But a lot of that has to do, even with that right breed, if they aren't well socialized to people during that early socialization period, which is earlier than people might think. It's about 3 to 12 weeks of age. So obtaining puppies at 16, 20 weeks of age, if they were not exposed to people and did not learn to trust and bond with them, they may have a hard time trusting them later.
We have got a note from Marianne on Facebook. Dr. McConnell, I'm going to direct it to you. I'm wondering, she says, where I can get one of those loyal, devoted dogs who want nothing more than to serve their masters. In my house, the dogs Vinny and Jackson, not to mention Cat Oliver, know I'm there to do their bidding, just like Luke and Cody and Jenny and all the pets before them. To what extent did you look at how people like to take care of their pets, and that's part of what creates that healthy atmosphere, or those healthy, or those balanced qualities you were talking about?
So that's a really good question. We, in our initial research, we haven't really explored that question directly, but we currently have a project going on right now where that's one of our major questions, which is kind of looking at the quality of the interactions that people have with their pets. And a lot of it's kind of, you know, there's a lot of needs that get expressed. Sometimes, you know, people view their pets as an opportunity to demonstrate nurturance, or to watch something grow, or to, you know, kind of develop this interdependence and this mutual need that, you know, I think we get from a lot of our healthy human relationships as well. And our hypothesis is that that's probably pretty critical for having high quality, sort of interactions with their pets. We have some preliminary data that we just submitted to a conference a couple weeks ago that bears that out. I think we want to run another study to kind of replicate that before I want to really go too far out on a limb and say that that seems to be the case. But we think that really a lot of what people get out of pet ownership often is not the glamorous stuff of, you know, just the dog walks, but it's kind of that sense of being needed and being a part of kind of a growing, evolving relationship that really makes it special and distinctive.
And from Donnie on Facebook writes, Dr. Heron has made a huge difference for our dog situation at home. My wife moved in with her two beagles, and my dog, Sonoma, didn't connect very well, ending in several biting incidents. We learned a lot about our dog's behavior through sessions with Dr. Heron and how we could handle it and make her feel less stressed in certain triggering situations. Highly recommend her if you're at that point of having no clue what to do. Let's hear from Yen in Columbus. Hi, Yen. You're on the air. Welcome to the show.
Hi. Great show, Ann. Thanks.
Thank you.
I just wanted to comment because I have three dogs that I have adopted from the shelter or from rescue organizations, and all three of them I adopted when they were already adults, and they all had some kind of trust issues that lasted for kind of a long time, but they definitely have improved over time. I have one that I always joke that he has puppy PTSD because there's some situations that will just throw him into a panic, but he definitely, I mean, we've had him for 3 years now, and he just continues to improve over time, little by little. Like, you don't really notice it except for when you think back, gosh, when we first got him, he was hiding behind a chair, and he wouldn't even look at us. And now he comes and elicits us petting him and all kinds of stuff. So I mean, they have made my life so much better just seeing them improve and
that's just really going to make you feel good.
It really does. And they're just, I mean, they do, that one in particular, when he comes up to love you, like, you just feel like you're the most loved person in the world.
That's nice. Well, thank you, Yen.
Thank you.
Dr. McConnell, what about people with dogs that have troubled personalities? There's some that maybe it's PTSD or whatever it might be. Do they have that same sense of well-being?
I don't know if I know that much really about sort of dysfunctional pet personalities. We looked to basically see if there were any sort of matching, that there are some variability in dogs in terms of kind of their outgoingness, their trainability, their kind of temperament. And what we found is that people got more benefits from dogs that had more positive temperaments and things like that. There's a couple questionnaires that have been developed by people who kind of know this area pretty well about trying to assess dog personalities, but we haven't done too much work beyond just one study in that regard.
Do you think the fact that you're even doing this work, Dr. McConnell, is reflective of our growing attachment to our animals? You said before it was more people who already had health problems or that sort of thing and what the impact was, but now it's just everyday people.
Well, I think it's really quite obvious that, you know, pets are a huge part of people's lives. I mean, you know, annually, in the United States alone, people spend $50 billion on pets and pet care. And, you know, there's a number of studies that, you know, one poll showed, for example, that 25% of married people feel like their dog is a better listener than their spouse. So I think that, you know, you look at political campaigns. I mean, dogs are very essentially kind of featured, you know, both for positive and negative sorts of comments in those sorts of domains. So I think that, you know, our culture really values, I think, these sorts of relationships, and it's growing, but it's also a worldwide phenomenon. I mean, you know, you can look at places like, you know, Brazil has 30 million dogs, for example, which you would just a surprising number of dogs. So I think it's a pretty common phenomenon, but I think it's one that, you know, given people's interest in it, people are now starting to ask the questions of, you know, what are the functions of these pets?
Dr. Heron, your practice and so forth, people more and more feel like it's worth saving the pet and
Absolutely.
Fixing the relationship.
Absolutely.
No problem with that.
No.
Well, thanks for joining us today, Dr. Heron.
I appreciate it. It's my pleasure being here.
Dr. Megan Heron, she is the head of the Behavioral Medicine Clinic at Ohio State University's Veterinary Medical Center, and also Dr. Alan McConnell. Thanks for joining us, Dr. McConnell.
Thank you, Ann.
Happy travels.
Thank you.
Dr. Alan McConnell, he's social psychologist and professor at Miami University at Oxford, Ohio. Thanks for listening. This is All Sides with Ann Fisher on 89.7 NPR News.